Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we hear some cosmic Christmas tunes.
And our Eating Christmas essay series continues.
But first, it is time for the Friday newscap, and normally we'd hear some voices from the news this week, but today we'll be taking a look back at Arizona politics over the course of the past year and a little bit of a look ahead to what 2026 may have in store. So let's get right to the conversation. And for that, I'm joined by Chip Scutari of SNC Communications. Good morning, Chip.
Good morning, and happy early Festivus.
Happy early Festivus, indeed. Former state lawmaker Jen Longden. Jen, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hopefully no airing of grievances during the next segment here. So, Chip, I want to start with Senator Mark Kelly, who has been in the news pretty much all year long. Recently, though, of course, he was part of the video that a number of Democratic federal lawmakers made, essentially saying to service members, you are allowed to and, in fact, have the responsibility to disobey illegal orders, not really spelling out what that might be or if there have been any. He's kind of in hot water with the Defense Department. He's in hot water with President Trump. I'm curious, like, when you look at where things stand right now, we saw just this week that Pete Hegseth is saying this has been escalated now to potential discipline. What do you make of where we are right now?
Well, I think this is all a result of the strikes on the alleged drug boats off the coast of Venezuela. Mark Kelly served in the military, was an astronaut. I think this is passionate to his core. I do think, you know, that video was a very well done, highly designed effort to, you know, probably provoke the Trump White House. And I think they really believe what they were saying, but it has really put him in the limelight. I don't know if that was his plan. There was six or seven other Democrats who served
overall,
in the military
yeah.
or the CIA. One thing about Senator Kelly we've noticed in the last year, we were just talking about it off air, is his public profile has really grown over the last year or so, ever since he was considered for a VP slot for
Kamala Harris.
So I think, you know, he's going to fight this to the end. I don't think he has anything to lose. I think the legal case is on his side. And who knows if this could be a launch to the 2028 presidential campaign. There'll be a gazillion folks wanting to, you know, have their name on that list. But I think it's really put him in the spotlight for the next couple of years, especially next year for the midterms, which would be crucial for both political parties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jen, we've seen that Senator Kelly has raised what a lot of folks in politics have called presidential amounts of money. Presumably, that ability would be helpful, especially if his name ID is even higher, helping out other Democrats in 2026.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the news conference he did following the initial backlash from the video, as I watched that, I saw, you know, the potential launch of a presidential campaign in that moment where he compared his personal career timeline to that of this president. You know, I think that I can't believe there is anyone in this nation that doesn't recognize Mark Kelly as a man of valor and integrity. And the comments, the video was straightforward. There was nothing in that video specifically that called any member, any service member, to an act. It reminded them of their duty. It's something that happens in boot camp. It's something that happens routinely. There was nothing wrong with that video.
And I think the bigger picture here is I don't know if these Democrats, including Senator Kelly, would have done this a year ago. Mm. I'm not saying they did this because of President Trump's falling poll numbers, but you see more and more people willing to stand up to Donald Trump, which just, you know, 6 months ago he had a vice grip on the party. We saw it with the state senators in Indiana saying no thanks to redistricting,
yeah.
even coming under very tough threats about, you know, dollar funding for roads and primaries. So we see a fraying of the Trump base a little bit. Well, he's had he's got nine million lives. We'll see. He could bounce back. But this is one of those examples of people pushing back against the Trump presidency.
And remember, this administration is less than a year old. And I think that a year ago, folks were still practicing decorum, still practicing, and not that everyone has left decorum behind. I think this administration has done that to a certain degree. But I think that folks came in exercising the standard decorum of the institution. And we've recognized that that is not an effective tool for dealing with this administration. And they're being more blunt than they were a year ago.
Go ahead, Mark. But
no, finish up.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, former President Biden fell into the trap of, while the metrics on the economy look good, and him and Senator Harris, or Vice President, were saying, hey, trust us, it's not that bad, it's pretty good. And I think Donald Trump, he usually, if you like him or not, love him, loathe him, he really has a good pulse of the people. Mm-hmm. And I think he's falling into the Biden trap of just saying, hey, folks, everything is fine. He called affordability a hoax, which really backfired. So he's not – I think he's lost touch with the common man, it seems. He hasn't been out on the road a lot. You don't see him doing a lot of rallies. You don't see him just go to a school or an event like somewhere in the heartland. So I think he's falling into that trap of saying, no, everything's fine. Don't worry about it. And people are like, our healthcare is skyrocketing. You know, we can't afford a home. And those issues will define the 2026 elections.
So before we go back to D.C., Jen, I want to come back to Phoenix for a little bit. And I apologize to take you back to the state capitol, a place where you served for a little while. I was looking back at some of the stuff that we talked about over the course of the year from the legislature, and there's some stuff I'd totally forgotten about. I suspect that some people had as well.
I try.
you try. So there was obviously issues with Prop 123, the funding for education, which did not end up happening this year, a renewal of that. There was the bill dealing with funding for repairs to Chase Field. Mm-hmm. There was the so-called Axon bill, which is still causing waves in Scottsdale. There was a lot of budget drama going on with the chambers sort of each passing their own bill and sort of playing chicken with each other to see which one would get passed. A lot of vetoes. When you look back at the months and months that state lawmakers were in session, was there a common theme to you or like a common thread that stood out from 2025?
Chaos. I think, usually, at least the public-facing side is more united within the parties and within the chambers. Mm-hmm. And all of the inner party fighting and then, you know, across the aisle, it happens. But this, we're currently seeing more fighting within each chamber, within each caucus in a way that, I'm just glad I'm gone at this point in time. I don't think we're making good public policy. I think we're performing in some cases.
Speaking of that, I think there's a grand bargain to be had on Prop 123. Mm. The Common Sense Institute did a great report about if potential state trust land reform.
Yeah.
You know, there's still 9 million acres we are not using, and it could be a trifecta to help out not only education and our kids, but affordable housing and maybe location for data centers. It'll be interesting to see if Governor Hobbs or someone – it's a big lift. And there's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah.
But there is a big grand bargain to be held that could really, you know, affect the state positively for decades and decades. So I'm anxious to see if someone will take that on. I thought it was a great report by the Common Sense Institute about just laying out the case for how many billions of dollars are out there if we just – develop, you know, use that land that was bequeathed to us at statehood in 1912.
Well, so Chip, Jen mentioned sort of intra and inter-party squabbles. And, you know, we saw even at the end of the session, right after the legislature adjourned, Senate Republicans change out their leadership. I mean, what does that portend for 2026, do you think?
Well, just to that point, we could see a change in the Senate presidency.
Yeah.
So right. If Warren Peterson is running for attorney general 2026 next year, if there's rumors that he may leave and Senator John Kavanaugh or Senator T.J. Shope will want that position, that could shake up a lot of things because, you know, Warren Peterson has been against short-term rental reform, hasn't been too helpful on affordable housing. And, you know, Senator Kavanaugh, even though he's very conservative, he's more pro short-term rental reform. So that could tip the balance. So there's a lot that will happen in the next month or so that could determine how the legislative session looks.
Yeah, it's going to be about a month or so till lawmakers come in. And, Jen, we've seen some bills pre-filed already. Is it too early to tell sort of what the tone and tenor might be? Of course, 2026, an election year, all 90 lawmakers, at least those who are running, are up.
Right. So I'd like the issues that you've already mentioned, right? Prop 123, we need a good budget. I think we have major water issues yet that haven't been dealt with that we're going to have to be talking about. And there's going to need to be some strong leadership within the legislature, a willingness to work with the governor. That has been one of the issues we've seen is I think majority has teed up legislation in a way to try and box in the governor and make her look bad. I don't think they've been as successful as they'd like to be. So I'd like to see folks working together to get these things done. What do you think? Do you think there are any adults in the room?
No.
I'm not making any friends. I won't be able to go down there this
there's
year.
There's a few. But there'll be issues that, you know, I saw one guy just filed a bill to eliminate daytime speed limits. So, you know, those
on some like rural highways, not like on I-10 outside the windows here.
So my point is there will be two or three issues. It's not even on our radar right now. Right. That will dominate
every year.
Chunks of time.
Right.
But, you know, I wish, you know, that there'd be more consensus at the Capitol. But in election year, you know, with the governor up, the secretary of state, attorney general, these congressional swing districts. I don't think there's going to be a lot of collaboration at the Capitol. I hope I'm wrong, but we'll see what, you know, Governor Hobbs can, in her State of the State address, really use a bully pulpit to cast a vision for the state. And we'll see if she takes that opportunity.
Quickly before we go to break, was there anything from 2025 from the session that you think will be particularly impactful for Arizonans going forward?
We're both looking at each other.
Oh, I was going to say the ag to urban bill.
That would be
beneficial. I think the Axon bill, if it plays out, could be a huge benefit to Scottsdale and the region. The Diamondbacks bill was a big deal, whether you like it or not. That's
to renovate Chase Field.
Chase Field and to keep the team here and all the economic development in downtown.
I think that worked out. Yeah. I do. I didn't mean to interrupt you. But, you know, the union jobs that are coming out of that, the compromise that didn't take all of the city revenue away, I think that's going to end up a win-win. I'm not a huge fan of sports. And, you know, if rich people need somewhere to park their sports team, they should pay for it. But until I became a legislator and started recognizing all of these other issues,
All right. That is Jen Longden. I'm also joined by Chip Scutari. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the year-end newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, former state lawmaker Jen Longden and Chip Scutari of SNC Communications. Jen, we did have some elections in 2025. I want to talk about one in particular, that, of course, the CD7 in Southern Arizona, the special election, which Adelita Grijalva, now Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva, won to replace her late father, Raul. This kind of turned into a bit of a thing, right, when it took about a month or so for her to get sworn in. It became this huge controversy. She kept saying that it was because she was going to be the final signature needed on a discharge petition to force a vote on releasing the Epstein files. She eventually did get seated after quite a while. It happened, of course, also during the government shutdown. I'm curious, like looking back on it now with a little bit of hindsight, like I'm curious what you make of how that whole scenario played out.
Well, the amount of time it took to swear in was absolutely ridiculous. And I do believe that it was related to the discharge petition and the shutdown. There was another lawmaker, Tennessee, right? How many days was he sworn in after he won his special?
He won more. I think he was sworn in within a week or so winning that election.
Yeah, days, not like weeks and weeks and weeks. So, you know, I wonder what that difference was. But, you know, I'm glad Congresswoman Grijalva is there. The folks of Southern Arizona deserve robust representation. She is offering that already. And I'll also point out that the Epstein files are supposed to be released this afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm grateful for the loud voices from Arizona, especially our senators. You know, Senator Gallego really got loud on that issue. And I'm, you know, as someone who has survived childhood sexual violence, I'm grateful he was there to do that. So let's get this done.
Yeah. Well, I think Speaker Mike Johnson, if he could do it all over again, he probably should have seated Congresswoman Grijalva immediately, because there was immediate blowback. Her name ID was off the charts. I mean, my friends in other parts of the country, like, we know who this congresswoman from Tucson is, you know. So I think they were going to get the discharge petition anyway. So I think it blew up in their face. I don't know why he did that. I'm sure he wanted to delay the release of the Epstein files. But for her, she's there now for CD7 representing her constituents. And I think she has a bigger voice now because of this than if, you know, when someone's typically elected, like, okay, Joe Smith, blah, 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 you move on. But now her name is kind of resonating throughout the Capitol's corridors in D.C.
Right.
So,
more to Chip's point, I mean, that's absolutely true. I mean, here in Arizona, you certainly keep track of those members. But on the national stage, a steady seat that, you know, isn't in contention, someone takes it and holds it for 15, 20 years until they're ready to give it up. Those people tend to disappear in the background. I don't recognize those people in other states. And now everyone knows the name and will say it loud and proud, Adelita Grijalva.
All right. So one of the interesting things, we obviously, of course, have many, many elections coming up in 2026. One of the more interesting things, at least to me from this past year, was the fact that the Freedom Caucus, the Arizona Freedom Caucus, is basically putting up its own slate of candidates. In some cases, like, for example, in the Secretary of State's race, there's only one candidate, Representative Alexander Colladan. But, you know, in the Superintendent of Public Instruction race, the Freedom Caucus is challenging Tom Horn with Treasurer Kimberly Yee. They have obviously taken sides in the governor's primary. Chip, I'm curious how you see that playing out. I mean, America Fest Turning Point event is in town right now. Like, how do you see that? Like, is this a division within the GOP? Is this just sort of the usual kind of, there are different factions of every party?
Yeah, it's definitely a division in the Republican Party. And I know they want their people to get elected, you know, the Freedom Caucus Turning Point. But I think Jen and her folks on the other side of the aisle are cheering this because they love the division. You know, like in Congressional District 1 to replace David Schweiker, you're going to have Gina Swoboda, who has the Trump endorsement, but she's seen more of a mainstream candidate compared to Joseph Chaplick, who just announced, who's a Freedom Caucus member, very conservative, very into election conspiracies back in 2020. And if you're a Democrat, you have to hope that the more conservative, the MAGA type, the Freedom Caucus makes it to the general election. Because the rule of thumb is if you're a centrist Democrat, you have a better chance, like, you know, Governor Katie Hobbs against Carrie Lake, or, you know, Ruben Gallego against Carrie Lake. So we'll see how that plays out, because I think, as we've seen in Virginia and New Jersey and these governor's races and other races across the country, it should be a good year for Democrats. They can mess it up. They're good at that. But it should be a better year for Democrats. So we'll see how all this plays out.
Is it dangerous, though, Jen, to sort of, as a Democrat, to hope for the Freedom Caucus, the Turning Point candidate, to win the primary? Because there's nothing that says they can't win the general, too.
Right. I think about that a lot when I celebrated this president's winning his primary. It's like, oh, we've got this. And then you end up with, you know, this particular perspective in the governing role. So I certainly have some concerns about that. I have a lot of concerns about that. You know, Joe Chaplick is a very effective campaigner. He'll be good on the stump. He very well could, you know, win the nomination and then go head to head against whoever comes out of my party primary.
And that's in the first congressional district, which is currently represented by David Schweikert. He, of course, this year announced he's running for governor. And CD1 is one of, at least on paper, one of the more, if not the most competitive district in Arizona, and one that Chip, national Democrats, basically, if they're going to retake the House, they see this as one they kind of have to win.
Yeah, I think this one, and then I think it's CD6 with Representative
Siskamani. Yeah, in Southern Arizona.
That's even tighter. So those two races, I think, are two of the top 10 most competitive races in the country. And I think it's going to come down to E.J. Gion, their columnist in the New York Times, had a great column about 6 days ago. He called it the reasonable majority. So where are the voters that supported Trump in 2024, maybe low propensity, low efficacy voters, or just people who believe he could help out reduce the cost of living? Where will those voters go? They're not really MAGA types. They're kind of swayable. And I think those types of voters will make the difference in all of these races, whether it's governor, whether it's CD1, CD6, those people who are not really sold on either party or either candidate.
Well, so, Jen, from a Democratic perspective, many of those voters presumably voted for the president, right? Mm-hmm. That he won a lot of low propensity voters. He was able to move a lot of formerly Democratic voters. So how do you think Democrats should be talking to those voters to try to win them back?
Well, certainly we need to focus on the breakfast table issues, right? Affordability. It is a real thing. Affordability is real. And I think that even in the previous race, we saw a lot of Trump voters who then voted for other folks, you know, split their tickets.
You had a lot of Trump Gallego voters,
yes,
for example.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. And I hope we'll continue to see that. I think that there has been a weakening of that MAGA base. They are growing disillusioned with the outcomes that they were promised have come to fruition and not the way that they expected them to. I think that'll play.
Yeah. We've said on the show before, too, that now all politics is national. It's not mm-hmm. local. So mm-hmm. things that happen in D.C., this healthcare issue, that will reverberate in Arizona and across the country. Things on AI can, you know, the federal government stop the states from regulating artificial intelligence. All these things will have huge impacts and repercussions for Arizona politics next year.
And back to that point, especially in Congress, but I think in state led races, this will play, too. You know, we did not continue the Affordable Care Act subsidies. Everyone is going to see their insurance premiums double, triple. Mine did. And that's going to come home. When those folks who, in order to save money, went from their silver plan to a bronze plan or a catastrophic plan, and suddenly they are facing huge debt as a result of their coverage, and they're paying a lot more than they should for it, they're going to start showing up at town halls. Do you remember that in the way back?
Yeah.
And, you know, folks are going to have to stand by the votes they took on these party principles that are now playing out in people's real lives.
All right. Very quickly, about 20 seconds left. I want to ask each of you, which race are you most interested in watching in 2026? Chip, I'll start with you.
The governor's race.
Governor's race. Yeah. Okay.
Governor.
Jen, governor's. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Jen Longden, Chip Scutari, thanks to you both. I really appreciate it. Happy holidays. Happy New Year.
Happy
Same
holidays to you.
To you.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we remember Rob Reiner by revisiting our 2020 conversation with the late filmmaker.
But first, if you're already sick of the same old Christmas music you hear playing everywhere you go this time of year, today we offer you some eclectic alternatives. Consider this. The Gospel of Matthew tells the story of the Magi, three wise men who travel to see the baby Jesus. Amongst religious scholars, there's a lot of debate about who those wise men are, where they came from, and why they're a part of the story. Valley musician Jason Woodbury has always been fascinated by the mystery of the Magi. And a while back, he came across a book by a scholar named Brent Landau. The book, Revelation of the Magi, is part of Landau's attempt to weave New Age religious thought into traditional biblical analysis. In his research, Landau came across some obscure texts in the Vatican known as the Apocrypha, ancient writings that aren't considered canonical, meaning you're not going to find them in your standard Bible. As Jason told my co-host Sam Dingman, all of this was right up his alley.
I always I grew up like loving, you know, Star Wars books, and they weren't, you know, they're not official. This isn't what really happened, but it's right. Sort of the expanded universe. And so I like to think of this as the Gospels expanded universe, the Three Wise Men expanded universe, cinematic universe.
Right.
And anyway, so I tracked down this book, Revelation of the Magi, and it tells an expanded version of the Three Wise Men story, in which the star that they follow to Bethlehem is actually the Christ spirit itself. And at one point they go into a cave, and the star descends and becomes a glowing baby.
Whoa.
That addresses them.
Okay, so the kind of mystical, trippier elements of this are coming into focus.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I do think that part of what makes Christmas such an exceptionally interesting time is that it's a time where a lot of things that we don't always stop to consider are considered and sort of commonplace. These notions of charity, these notions of taking care of each other, of extending goodwill to each other. And I think that beyond that, it's situated in a time of year where we're kind of moving from the end of one time into another through the changing of the year. And so to me, time starts to take on a kind of strange quality, and it feels a little liminal.
So you today, Jason, have selected five songs that for you get at the Christmas spirit that we're alluding to in this conversation.
Yeah, the cosmic Christmas spirit is how I've been describing it in my late night raves to anybody who will listen.
Well, let's listen to the first one. This is the Seeger Sisters, Oh, Watch the Stars.
Watch the stars, see how they run. Oh, watch the stars, see how they run. The stars run down at the setting of the sun. Watch the stars, see how they run.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I really love this one. This is from a record by the Seeger Sisters, 1957's American Folk Songs for Christmas, which was put out by Folkways Records. And this song, wasn't always really considered a Christmas song. It's a traditional black song that I think is sourced from St. Helena Island in South Carolina. And that line that always gets me is the stars run down at the setting of the sun, which sort of ascribes some sort of, I don't know, I know it's called anthropomorphizing when it's an animal, but I don't know what you call it when it's a celestial pomorphizing, whatever that
right,
is.
Right.
But it sort of ascribes this sort of this action of the stars like running down to meet us. And I find that just so incredibly beautiful.
Well, and of course, there's a direct tie back there to this idea of a star coming down and turning into a glowing baby who reveals the great truth of the universe and humanity.
That's right.
Well, let's listen to the next one, which is also star-related. This is not necessarily a traditional Christmas song, but you're going to tell us why you think it is.
Yeah.
This is David Bowie, Starman.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh.
Classic.
Yeah. He's singing about a starman, some sort of savior that is going to come down, and he'd like to come and meet us, but he fears he'd blow our minds, you know? And I think that it's pretty inarguable that the actual figure of Christ did sort of blow the minds of, you know, humanity. But, you know, what tied this one to me was he also, right before the impeccable guitar solo, sings, "Let the children boogie." And one of my favorite quotes from Jesus is in Matthew 18, where he talks about how we must become like little children in order to enter the kingdom of heaven. And so "Let the children boogie" to me sounds a little bit like a holy commandment from our departed Saint David Bowie.
All right. Well, let's get even more far out. The next one here is "Saturn" by the Sun Ra Orchestra. I should say the full title of this record is "Sun Ra and His Solar Orchestra Visits Planet Earth."
That's right.
Which again harkens back to our origin story that we've been talking about here.
Yeah, and we're keeping very much with the celestial theme here. You know, before there was Christmas, there was the Roman festival of Saturnalia, which was held on December 17th to honor the god Saturn. And Sun Ra himself, he claimed to be from Saturn. So in 1936 or 37, he had this sort of visionary experience where he was taken to the planet Saturn and told by the people there that the world would listen if he were to speak through music. But while I was getting ready for this talk, I was blown away to find that not only do we've got Saturnalia, not only do we have Sun Ra claiming to be an extraterrestrial from Saturn, but The astronomer Johannes Kepler suggests that the star that the three wise men followed might well have been a Jupiter-Saturn conjunction. So Sun Ra getting in there with a pretty heavy sensibility of bringing some weirdness to Christmas.
Well, we'll let Sun Ra fade into the outer solar system as we move on to the next one here. This is the band Red Red Meat with There's a Star Above the Manger Tonight. This harmony gives me chills.
Yeah. You know, this one's interesting because if you read the lyrics, lay down your last $20, shepherds are dead sober, whispering numbers. There's a star above the manger tonight. And also, the devil gets wise when you start to win. So he's talking about gambling. And one thing that's interesting is that during the Roman festival of Saturnalia, gambling was permitted. It wasn't the rest of the year. That's another thing about Christmas, right, is that we all get to take time off of our jobs. We all get to ignore our worldly responsibilities. Things that aren't normally permitted are permitted, you know. And then to have this beauty in the song, because as you mentioned, I mean, the strings, that incredible banjo run, there's something about that collision of the sacred and the profane. Sweet baby Jesus, give me luck at the tables. Yeah. I mean, there's something there.
Well, speaking of revelry, the last one here is a song that is very difficult not to get up and move around when you hear. This is Earth, Wind, and Fire, Shining Star. When you wish upon a star, your dreams will take you very far.
Yeah. He also sings, born a man-child of the sun, saw my work had just begun. So,
okay.
You know, I think it kind of ties through. This is from the Earth, Wind, and Fire album, That's the Way of the World, from 1975, which is a stone-cold classic, start to finish. And Earth, Wind, and Fire, although they were, I mean, just like huge hit makers, you can see that there's definitely like a metaphysical, cosmic side to what they're doing. And, you know, I think that in the 70s, you've kind of got this emerging notion from people like Carl Sagan, who are explaining to everyday people that, like, we are made of star stuff. And this cosmic vision of, like, that we ourselves sort of have something in common with the cosmos sort of pervades a lot of sort of mystical traditions. And I think that as you see that sort of integrated back into the culture in a real interesting way, songs like this, Shining Star, kind of become these anthems of self-actualization and self-improvement and sort of striving for being the best version of yourself that you can be. And I think that this year offers us an opportunity to focus on that notion of continual return, continual renewal, always being born, always becoming.
Well, I have been speaking with Phoenix, writer and musician, and I'm going to say it, lay theologian.
Oh, no.
Jason Woodbury, helping us build out a newer, more cosmically inspired Christmas playlist. Jason, thank you.
You can find a Spotify playlist with all of the songs that Jason featured in this conversation on our website at theshow.kjzz.org.
As we close out the week, we want to take a moment to talk about the man whose name dominated the headlines this week, Rob Reiner. The famed filmmaker and actor was killed alongside his wife in their California home on Sunday. Their adult son, Nick Reiner, was charged in their murders.
Since the news of the tragedy broke, there has been an outpouring of tributes from Reiner's Hollywood friends and colleagues. He'll be remembered as a great comic actor, master storyteller, and a giant in the film industry. He's made more movies that have turned into classics than most.
Why don't you tell me the story of your life?
The story of my life?
We've got 18 hours to kill before we hit New York.
Hey, you guys. I bet you anything that if we find him, we'll get our pictures in the paper. Yeah, yeah, we can even be on TV. Sure, we'll be heroes. Yeah.
Where is the poison? The battle of wits has begun. It ends when you decide and we both drink and find out who is right and who is dead.
But it's so simple. All I have to do is divine from what I know of you. Are you the sort of man who would put the poison into his own goblet or his enemy's?
Those are just a few of Reiner's greatest films, When Harry Met Sally, Stand By Me, and The Princess Bride. He also directed Misery, This Is Spinal Tap, and A Few Good Men.
Back in 2020, just before the pandemic hit, Reiner was here in Arizona, the guest of honor at the Sedona International Film Festival, where he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award. And I got the chance to talk with him on the show about it. And I asked him what he considers a classic, since he made so many.
You never know. When you're making a picture, you don't know what's going to stand the test of time, what's going to last. And I guess that's what classics are, things that, you know, over the decades, people still watch them and still enjoy it. But you don't know when you start out. You never know. I mean, you hope you're making something that people will connect with. And, you know, if they happen to connect with it and you've tapped into something that's, you know, kind of universal on a human level, then I guess they last.
But at the same time, he recognized the major changes in the industry and in our culture as fragmentation.
It's hard to reach a big audience because there's something like 500 television shows and over 60 outlets that you can find things. People don't watch things at the same time, so they don't have a shared experience. Mm. I mean, when we were doing All in the Family, there were only three major networks, and there was no, you know, DVR, no TiVo or anything like that. If you wanted to see the show, you had to watch it when it was on.
Yeah.
And we were a country of 200 million people, and on any given night on a Saturday, 40 to 45 million people would be watching the show and sharing that experience. Now, if you have a hit show, if you can get 10 million people to watch, that's a big deal. And like I say, there's so many channels, like you'll say a show that you love, and I may love that show too, but we can't talk about it because don't tell me I'm only on episode two or
right.
I'm only on the first season, you know, so everybody's a spoiler alert to everybody else. So you can't ever talk about the shows.
Did he ever think that we'd have classics again, like the ones he's made in the future?
I don't know. You know, I don't know. It's interesting you think about that because we're so separated. You know, technology is supposed to bring us together, but what it does is we're all in our little silos, in our little, you know, cubby holes of information and entertainment. So we're fragmented. The society is less communicative and more fragmented, I think, than it was before you had people standing at the water cooler, you know, talking about things that they shared. It started in the movies, you know, you'd have a movie experience where you're in the theater with people and actually sharing that experience. And television came along and everybody said, well, that's the end of that, you know. But now we're way beyond that to where people are not having those kinds of shared experiences. And I think that's not so good for us as a society. I think it's rough. It doesn't bring us together, that's for sure.
Yeah. So last question for you then, and along those lines, do you think in light of that, in light of this kind of fragmentation, you as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, can still kind of tell those universal stories and strike some kind of chord with people that will continue to resonate and maybe bring us together in some small way?
Well, you know, I don't know. All I know is that you learn to embrace the experience of making the movie or making the television show. You have to enjoy that, and because you don't know what is going to either resonate or what is going to be embraced by people. So you have to take pleasure in the doing, in the making of something. And, you know, the world will decide what lasts and what doesn't last.
Well, the world has definitely decided that Reiner's work will last and he will be remembered through it. That was my 2020 conversation with the late and legendary filmmaker Rob Reiner. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. As the year draws to a close, we're sharing memories of Arizonans who passed away in 2025. The OG Phoenicians out there will likely recognize the name Norman Fierros. Fierros ran several restaurants here over the span of a few decades. His creative cuisine drew fans from all over. He also worked as a hairdresser in Los Angeles and was an avid art collector. KJZZ contributor Robert Palo was a food writer when he first encountered Fierros. Later, the two would become friends.
So the one that he's known for is Fina Cochina. I think because that's where he introduced all of his signatures. He told me once that a chef only needed one signature dish to make it. And I don't know how serious he was about that, but his signature dish was actually wasn't a dish. It was his little chocolate chimichangas that he ended every meal with. So you didn't order them. They weren't on the menu, I don't think. They were little tiny bite-sized chimichangas with a big hunk of dark chocolate inside. And he swore that was it, that that was all he would be remembered for. But you know what I think his signature dish really was ceviche. In fact, he told me many years later when I interviewed him after he had stopped cooking, or cooking professionally, he said, I can ceviche anything. And he used to put things in ceviche that, let's just say, one didn't expect. So he used a lot of shrimp. And he wasn't trying to fool anyone. I mean, it was on the menu. It's just that his ceviche was never the same. Sometimes it had watermelon in it or pomegranate seeds or cantaloupe, shaved cantaloupe. His idea was ceviche is ceviche, but he took a lot of heat for using shrimp. I know that. And he didn't stop. He studied French cooking and Asian cuisines and brought a lot of those influences to the food. And this was, you know, that was not a popular notion or as popular a notion 30 years ago as it is now. And I think he was going for the unexpected. I think he wanted you to read the ingredients list and say, what? Why is there cantaloupe and shrimp in ceviche? But then if you were in Norman's restaurant, probably the next thing you would say is, I think I might try that because it's Norman. A lot of the things he did and took some heat for were not popular ideas when he was doing them, including being in downtown Phoenix. I think he was on Monroe Street in, you know, kind of a shady area for a little while. And there were lines at lunchtime during the week. That's pretty rare because people were like, it's Norman. I don't care where it is. I'm going. Norman always said, I am not a business person. So he would hook himself. He would hitch his wagon to the wrong star, and he did it repeatedly. There was one of his restaurants that closed because it was discovered that he had never paid taxes. Well, he wasn't running, you know, the front of the house, and he certainly wasn't doing the books. He was running the kitchen and, you know, writing the menus. He was in the last months of his life and saying to me, I'm going to come back and cook for Phoenix. I just got to get over this hump with my health, and I'm going to come back and cook for Phoenix because Phoenix wants me to make food for them.
That was KJZZ contributor Robert Pala remembering Norman Fierros, who is 83. You can find more remembrances of Arizonans who passed away in 2025 at KJZZ.org.
There's something fishy about our next Eating Christmas essay. Here's local writer Devin Kate Pope to explain.
When Facebook and I were young and innocent, one of my favorite lines to use in the About section was Irish with Italian taste buds. Most of my ancestors fled Ireland in the 1850s, but more recently, Angelo Passo came over from Rome, moved to Scranton, Pennsylvania, married Josephine Petrario, and had my step-great-grandfather, Leo. He died before I was born, so the little I know about him is important. Has Nona kept a pot of red sauce on the stove at all times? Leo loved my mom, and she adored him. My mom was the only grandchild welcomed into the kitchen to make the Feast of the Seven Fishes every year. Leo, his Nona, and my mom, starting early in the morning on December 24th, prepared the traditional dishes. Baked clams, fried smelts, salted white fish, the sea snail skungili, mussels, calamari, and lobster. I don't know if lobster was on the menu. The Passos weren't wealthy, and there were a lot of them. But I do know that there was shrimp, because they were my mom's job. Deveining pounds of crustaceans didn't sound fun to me, but my mom didn't complain. Even 30 years later, she glowed with pride, remembering the plate of her handiwork going around the table. She grew up, left home to start her family, intermittently talked with her parents, but on many Christmas Eves, she and I made the Feast of the Seven Fishes. In the kitchen, she told me about cooking with Leo and eating the feast. It sounded like the one day in the calendar year she truly believed in love, so real she could smell it and eat it. As I grew up, it was sometimes the Feast of the Four Fishes. Smelt and sea snail are hard to source in Phoenix. And today it's devolved into being just the Feast of the Shrimp Cocktail Ring from Costco. But it's a tradition among few that hasn't slipped away, a prized catch I hold tight. I was taught that the seven fish represent the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit, which you can remember thanks to a jaunty tune that I will now sing for you. Wisdom, understanding, counsel and fortitude, knowledge, piety, fear of the Lord. You always got to end on fear. It's the Catholic way. So you eat the fish, you receive the gifts. But who can prove the origins of food traditions? Piety may have been the genesis, or maybe some guy needed to sell a bunch of fish before Christmas. Either way, when December rolls around, I need wisdom to survive the holidays. I crave an understanding of my family, and I fear the times when fewer people are sitting at the table. If eating seven varieties of fish helps with this, sign me the f*** up. This year we'll be at my mother-in-law's, and she hates fish, but we'll be eating tamales, so don't feel bad for me. I will make the Feast of the Seven Fishes again someday. I'll cram my kitchen with an ungodly amount of sea creatures, give each of my kids a job, and tell them about Leo, who made Christmas Eve a gift, and taught their grandma, who taught me, to bake clams, fry smelts, and double-check the shrimp cocktails defrosted.
That was Devin Kate Pope performing live on stage at Crescent Ballroom. You can find more Eating Christmas essays at kjzz.org.
Hey, come on!
And that's it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being here. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.
No clams and spaghetti. A beautiful sight.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show.